This is Susan Vandenberg, along with Susan Locke, working for your liberty and things that matter here at WFYL 1180 AM. Today we have as our special guest William Federer, who is a nationally known speaker, best-selling author, and president of AmeriSearch, which is a publishing company dedicated to researching America's noble heritage. Bill's American Minute radio feature is broadcast daily across America and by the Internet. His Faith in History television show airs on the TCT network on stations across America. Welcome, Bill, and we know you care very much about things that matter.
Susan, great to be with you.
Why don't we start back at the beginning, Bill, and could you just fill us in a bit about how you decided to become a writer and why you do write?
Well, my dad is an attorney and historian and was the head of several historical societies, so growing up, we would stop at every French fort and Spanish fort and Indian reservation. Matter of fact, some of those metal historical markers alongside the road, he wrote a couple of those, and we would show up when they would unveil them. But it wasn't until I became an adult myself and really started reading the Bible and began to view history from a providential point of view. I didn't realize there were philosophies of history, but there's a linear view, which is that history is moving toward an event, and that's the Judeo-Christian version, and it's moving toward an ultimate day of reckoning, so to speak, and prophecies made, prophecies fulfilled. There's an animist view of history, which is the circle of life. Everything just keeps repeating itself. There's the Marxist view of history, where everything's a class struggle, and then there's the nihilist view of history, which is there's no purpose to anything. And unfortunately, that's the way it's often taught in schools. And so that's why it's boring, because there's no connection. It's like, you know, Samuel Gompers started a union, the pilgrims came over. It's like, and so it would be like learning all the 26 letters of the alphabet by just putting them all in a box and dumping them on a table and me saying, memorize them. And you're like, okay, here's an X, here's an L. No, when you have them in an order, and so when I began to see history in an order, it began to make a lot more sense. And there's only 60 pages, so to speak, in the history book. There's 60 centuries of recorded human history. So writing was invented about 3 or 4,000 B.C., Sumerian cuneiform on clay tablets in the Mesopotamian Valley, and Egyptian hieroglyphics on papyrus, where we get the word paper. And so from 3 or 4,000 B.C. to 2080 is 6,000 years, which in a sense is not that long. It's only 60 people living 100 years each back to back. Everyone's met someone who's lived 100 years, maybe a grandma. We're talking 60 grandmas, and you're all the way back to the beginning of recorded human history. And so when you look at it from that perspective, it's like, okay, it's finite. I can see what happened in this century, and it doesn't change. And then I go to the next century. And then you begin to see patterns emerge, and maybe I can get into some of that.
Absolutely. Go ahead. As you gave the history of recorded human, history, it's just like, have we learned anything? What have you seen in terms of patterns? Where are we headed these days?
Well, the biggest pattern I found was that power accumulates into the hands of one person. And we call this person by different names. Pharaohs, Caesars, Kaisers, Sultans, Tsars, Maharaja, Genghis Khan, Julius Caesar, Attila the Hun, Muslim Sultans, the Chinese Emperors, the King Kamehameha, King of Spain, France, Austria. No matter which century you pick, you are going to read the story of kings. And so this is the norm for human government, that power gravitates into the hands of one person. And, of course, I believe, just sort of spiritualizing, it sort of goes back to the original sin, the fall in the garden, Cain killing Abel, and selfishness coming into the human DNA, so to speak. So if you put some babies in a playpen, one of them will wind up taking the rattle from the others. And if you put some kids on a playground, one of them will wind up being the bully, hogging the ball. And you drop some people in the woods, one of them's the Indian chief, and drop them in an inner city, one of them's the gang leader. So it's sort of like the Lord of the Rings. Everyone wants this ring of power. And all a king is, in a sense, is a glorified gang leader. and so it comes up with something called the patronage system, where if you are friends with the king, you are more equal. If you are not friends with the king, you are less equal. And if you're an enemy of the king, you're dead. It's called treason. So for most of world history, equality was how close of an orbit can you get to the king. It's a hierarchical system with the king at the, you read Hammurabi's Code around 1728 BC, one of the first written laws on, and it's hierarchical. There's the king, and he's at the top, and then there's the royalty class, and then the merchant artisan class, and then there's the peasant class, and then there's the slaves. And the punishment for crimes committed against the different ones varies on if whether they're closer to the top or not. And so this is the norm. When I speak in schools, I'll have the kids hold up a fist in one hand and say, concentrated power. And then I say, open up your other hand with your fingers apart and say, separated power. And then go back to the fist. And I say, that is world history. For most of history, power is in the hands of these kings. It's very rare that people get an opportunity to stretch the rubber band and put power in the hands of the people. But in times of crises, the rubber band snaps back. And so I decided to set out and try to identify these very rare opportunities that people had to stretch the rubber band and put power in the hands of the people. And the first well-recorded instance of an entire nation being ruled without a king was Israel. Around 1500 BC, give or take a century, is when Israel came out of Egypt. And who controlled everything in Egypt? Why, the Pharaoh. He owned the land, the people, the cattle, everything. And in Israel, when the children of Israel showed up, they did not have a king for around 300 years. They were all equal before the law. And the law said there's no respect of persons in judgment. Rich or poor, everyone's the same. Male, female, made in the image of the Creator. That even the stranger living amongst you is under the same law that you're under. You compare that today to maybe the Islamic Sharia law, where if you're a non-Muslim, you're called a dhimmi, and you have no rights in front of a Muslim court. And we're seeing cases like a woman in Sudan is sentenced to death simply because she converted to Christianity. But in Israel, everyone was equal. Even the stranger living amongst them was equal. Lo and behold, Israel was the first instance on the planet where they had the concept of equality, that everyone is equal because everyone's made in the image of the Creator, not based on how close of an orbit can you get to the king, because they didn't have a king. And then Israel was different in many other ways. They had no prison system because the law said, okay, there's swift justice at the gates of the city, and then you had a city of refuge you could run to. They had no welfare system because that law said when you harvest your field, you leave the gleanings for the poor people to pick through. The law said that everyone had to learn the law and enforce it. So they had no police because everyone knew the law and everyone enforced the law. And they had the first nation with private land ownership. Now, how many of us like to own land? Well, Israel was the first instance of private land ownership. All those boring chapters where they did surveys and lots and they divided up the land and this tribe gets from the river to the sea, and you're like reading chapter after chapter, and it's like, Caleb's daughter gets off the donkey at her wedding and asks her dad for the spring on the other side of the field, and he says, okay. And my mom's name is Tirzah. And the first mention of Tirzah in the Bible is she was the daughter of Zelophehad, this old guy who had no sons. So the girls go to Moses and say, don't we get land too? Is our dad's name going to be forgotten? And Moses said, you get land, just marry someone within your tribe. But this was unheard of, individual women getting land, individual families owning land, where in Egypt the Pharaoh owned all the land. Even if you sort of had land in Egypt, it was conditional of you staying on the nice side of the Pharaoh. If you crossed him, he would take your land and your life. But in Israel, the land was permanently titled to the families. So if they got in a pinch and sold it, every 50 years it came back. And so this is the beginning of the idea of private land ownership. Now, if you think, if you can own land, you can accumulate stuff. Sheep, cattle, grain. The Bible called that being blessed. Karl Marx called it being a capitalist. You got capital, you got stuff, you worked hard and you saved it. And so, so Israel's whole experiment was dependent on one thing, priests teaching the law. Since human nature, like gravity, wanted to have that rubber band snap back into the hands of a king, what they were doing was counter human nature. And so it was the priest's job to teach every new generation the law. And sort of like, you know, every computer you buy has a preloaded virus on it, and so you have to get a programmer to reprogram. And so it's like every, you know, child born has this selfish, fallen human nature. And so the priest's job was to teach them this alternative system of self-control. And as long as the priests did that, their experiment of ruling themselves continued. But when the priests stopped teaching the law, everyone did what was right in their own eyes, and they had, you know, sodomites surrounding houses and banging on the doors and concubines being chopped up, and you're like, gross. And then finally Eli's own sons, who he's the high priest, his sons are sleeping with women in the tabernacle of meeting, and there's immorality everywhere. And finally the people go to the Samuel, the prophet, and they said, this isn't working. We decide we want to be like all the other countries. We want a king. And Samuel cries, and the Lord told Samuel, they did not reject you, they rejected me. Mm-hmm. And so the perfect plan for Israel was to not have a king, everybody be equal, everybody own private property and be blessed, and the priest teaching them this system. And so it's what I call a sliding scale of virtue, where one side is total government, the other side's no government, and no government would be anarchy unless the people have lots of internal morals and virtues, and which is the priest's job to teach them. And so as people give up their morals and virtues and give into their passions and lusts, there's more crime, there's more chaos, and the people say, government step in, restore order, and the government's happy to, but in order to do that, they have to consolidate power and concentrate it into fewer and fewer hands until finally you get back to the king.
That's fascinating, Bill. This is Susan Locke here at WFYL. We're speaking with William Federer, who's the author of many books. We can understand from what you've just explained to some degree where your inspiration comes from and how history has impacted you and how you have discerned purposes throughout the years. How many books have you written to date, Bill?
Well, I've written about 20, and they all have to do with our history and you know, how we got to where we're at. What I'm saying is not new. Matter of fact, the original proponent of Common Core was Noah Webster. And, he was in the Connecticut legislature, the Massachusetts legislature. He was a judge, and of course, he wrote Webster's Dictionary. Mm-hmm. He also wrote a blueback speller, which sold hundreds of millions of copies. And so for generations, Noah Webster was considered the father of education in a public education in America. Mm-hmm. And in 1832, Noah Webster said this, "The brief exposition of the Constitution of the United States will unfold to young persons the principles of republican government, that the genuine source of correct republican principles is the Bible, particularly the New Testament and the Christian religion. Republican government loses half its value where the moral and social duties are imperfectly understood or negligently practiced." And he says, "To exterminate our popular vices is a work of far more importance to the character and happiness of our citizens than any other improvements in our system of education." And, you know, it's just the idea that you can have brilliant thieves. You know, I mean, what are we mm-hmm. teaching the kids that if you tell them, you know, what they can do, but you don't tell them whether or not they should do it? Another instance that I found worth noting is Greece. Now, about 600 years B.C., which so Israel's experiment was probably maybe David was the king probably around 1000 AD. So we're talking maybe, you know, 1300 to 1000 BC was Israel's experiment at self-government. But let's fast forward to 600 BC and you have Athens. Now Athens had a king named Draco, and it was the death penalty for every other crime. And so his laws were called the Draconian laws. And that's where we get the term for being very strict. The people of Athens dump and get rid of Draco, get rid of him. They get a new king named Solon, S-O-L-O-N, Solon. And Solon invented democracy and then left town, so they had to do it. And so in a democracy, everybody every day had to go to the market and talk politics. And if you did not keep up with politics every day in Athens, you were called an idiotus. an idiot. Now, when the people of Athens made the decisions, it created some dynamics. In other words, if there's a king and you have an agenda, you got to get in to see the king to pitch your agenda. And so the king had doorkeepers, like the Mandarin eunuchs in China kept the harems of a couple thousand women, but they were the doorkeepers, and you'd have to bribe them with favors just to get in to see the emperor. Well, in Athens, there was no emperor. The people made the decisions. Well, if you have an agenda, how do you pitch your agenda to the whole city? That's when they invented theater. They would get the whole city together in an amphitheater, and they would put on plays where they would have comedies and tragedies, where they would make fun of certain points of view and ridicule and buffoon them, and then they would honor and extol other points of view. And so you would leave the theater saying, I don't want to be like that fool, and gee, I want to be like that person that was honored and respected. And so from that time till now, theater is always political in a country where the people make the decisions. We think of your favorite show today, and there's some character that you identify with. And as the series or show goes on, this character begins to make morally compromising decisions. And you find yourself apologizing for them, saying, yeah, I know James Bond is with women he's not married to, but he's about to save the world, so let's get on with the story. And so you minimize that. And then they usually make the buffoons, the simpletons, the people that maybe hold to old traditional values. And so you leave watching this show thinking, I don't want to be like that simpleton and this other one, you know. And so from that, from Athens till today, theater is always political. Somebody is writing the script. Somebody's paying the actors. Somebody's paying the theater. Somebody's paying a lot of money to put that on. Another thing in Athens is called rhetoric. You think, what's rhetoric? Well, it's the persuasiveness in your speech. And so if the people are the deciders and you have an agenda, you got to sway the people. So there's three parts to rhetoric. One is called ethos, and then logos, and then pathos. Ethos comes from the word ethics, but it's the ethical trustworthiness, reputation of the person that's doing the speaking. And so that's boiled down to us as the introduction of someone before they give their talk. If they get up and start talking, you're like, who is this guy? But if they give the introduction, they say, this guy's an expert at this, that, and the other, and you can trust him because he knows his stuff. He's got all these degrees. And so it builds this person up so he can say the same thing. It just carries more weight because he has this ethos about him. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does.
And then the second is called logos, and that's the logical argument that this person presents. The third is pathos, where we get the word passion, and that's the emotional pull of the person. A lot of times people will say, well, you know, Republicans are better at logos and logic, and the Democrats are better at pathos, passion, you know. But these were first developed in Athens, where it was the people that were deciding the fate of the city, and if you had an agenda, you had to sway the people. So you did it through theater, and you did it through these speaking skills of ethos, logos, and pathos. Anyway, what happened in Athens? There was a guy who lived there named Plato, P-L-A-T-O. And around 300 or so B.C., Plato said that the government in Athens would go through five stages. Real quick, the first stage is called rule of the capable. These are people that know how to run farms and businesses, and they know how to run city governments. They're just responsible people. He called them lovers of truth, lovers of principle, lovers of virtue. And they do a good job. The city grows. And a second group is attracted to political office. And he called them lovers of fame, lovers of honor. These are people that have no experience running anything. They just got famous. Maybe they were a Greek actor that everyone loved, or a Greek Olympic athlete, or maybe a battle hero. And they go into politics with the best of intentions. But the bottom line, they don't have experience running anything, and because they love to be honored, they hate to be dishonored, and so this group of politicians can be manipulated by public opinion. If the public says, oh, we don't like you if you do this, well, then they'll bend, and we love it if you do this, then they'll bend. People say, well, you know, the politician I voted for, when he first went in, he was principled, and he would stand up for something no matter what people said, but now he's one that can be swayed. And we've, you know, obviously can see that happen with politicians currently. Well, Plato said that because these lovers of honor and fame have no experience running anything, they yield to the human tendency of avarice or selfishness, and they can't resist the temptation to vote just a little money out of the city treasury to pad their retirement. I mean, they're working hard. They vote a little money to their brother-in-law's construction company to do some public project, and then they vote a little money from the public treasury to some friend of theirs who is a supporter that can funnel the money back into their campaign and help get reelected. And before you know it, it turns into a third category called oligarchy, a rule of few, an insider clique, a ruling class. And these people, Plato called them lovers of money. They want money to get elected, and then they funnel money to their friends once they're in, as pork. He says that they pass laws that everyone else has to obey, but they exempt themselves. They raise taxes on everybody else, but they exempt themselves. And so this third, so we've gone from rule of the capable to rule of the famous to rule of an oligarchy. Then the people get upset and they vote the bums out and they set up a democracy. This is great. The people finally get to decide the fate of their own city, but they don't have any experience running a city government. Plato said at first, a democracy is the most charming form of government. It's like a bazaar where you can go down and shop and pick any type of viewpoint you want. It's like an embroidery patchwork with lots of different colors. And he says that the chief characteristic of a democracy is tolerance, love of equality. And so we've gone from lovers of virtue, the first category, to lovers of fame, the second category, to lovers of money, the third category, to lovers of tolerance. And Plato says this is great. He says everybody learns to get along. But he says then they begin to tolerate people that are a little bit off. And then they tolerate people that are a little bit more off. And until finally they're tolerating criminals that commit crimes and they just openly walk down the street and nobody cares. And then Plato says that this anarchy creeps into the home. And the sons are rebellious and disrespectful to the fathers and the fathers put up with it. And then he says it creeps into their morality and they give into unnecessary pleasures like incest and unnatural union. And the young man departs with all shame, and if you correct him, he just shakes his head. And finally, this anarchy creeps into their handling of money. And they realize that the city treasury has been sitting there this whole time, and it's a democracy, so all they got to do is vote, and they can spread the wealth around. And so they have it. They raid the treasury and spread the money. Now there's no money left. And they say, where can we get more money? And they say, well, the rich people, they got money. And so then they vote to take the money from the rich people. Now there's no rich people left. And then there's a shortage of money, and they begin to bicker amongst themselves. It's a tug of war. They argue and they complain, and finally it turns into chaos and anarchy. And then they begin to say, can't someone come along and fix this mess? And that's the fifth stage. Someone comes along, and they're all smiles, and they promise everything to everybody, and they're very eloquent and persuasive and charismatic and give great speeches. And as people begin to trust this person, they yield their rights, their freedom, their power, their authority, and this person begins to consolidate power. And then he yields to the avarice, selfish nature, and he cannot resist the temptation to use the powers of government to target his political opponents, and he has them falsely accused and drug away. Finally, he stands in the chariot of state, holding the reins of power, and he is revealed as the tyrant. And so Plato says that democracy without virtue and morality ends up in chaos, out of which a tyrant arises. And so now we have a flashback to Israel, that Israel, as long as they had virtue, then they could have maximum freedom. But when they gave up their virtue, there was chaos, and then they got King Saul, who turned around and killed all the priests. Well, in Athens, Plato said that as long as the people have virtue, they can have this democracy, this freedom. But when they give up their virtue, they give into their passions and lusts, they depart with deferred gratification, you know, save now, buy later. They want their money now. And then it turns into chaos. They want a quick fix, and someone comes along promising to fix it, and he ends up being a dictator. But Plato goes on and says, this tyrant will forever be getting into wars, because the people want a strong leader in time of war. He says that this tyrant, when he is finally confronted, he has the choice of giving up power, which he's not inclined to do, or purging his administration and staff of anybody that holds virtue. And so he doesn't want people that have a higher moral standard. He wants people that will obey him. And so he purges the military of all the old generals, and he purges all of the staff. And then finally, it's that Plato says that who does he get to be his followers? He lets the criminals out of the prisons. They're loyal to him now because he freed them. And so they're his mob, and he sends them out and stirs them up to go after his political opponents. It's amazing that he wrote this in 380 B.C., this insight into human nature that was Plato in Athens, Greece, in his book, Republic. But Plato said, well, since there are no virtuous people, he went on to say, you know, if somebody has the choice between death or giving up their virtue, they'll probably give up their virtue. And so if they're willing to give up their virtue, they were probably never really virtuous to begin with. They were just pretending like they were virtuous. And so Plato says there aren't any truly virtuous people on earth. He said if a truly virtuous person was ever born on earth, the people would probably crucify him.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of interesting he said that in 380 B.C. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so he said that since people genuinely don't have virtue, that you're going to have a democracy wind up in chaos, you're going to get a tyrant. He says the best you can hope for is a nice tyrant. So he called him a philosopher king. And he said this nice tyrant will take the children away from the family and bring them from the farms into the city, and he will indoctrinate them with noble lies. And he said it's okay for him to teach them lies because the lies help him stay in power. And since he's the best you can hope for and he knows how to run things, it's okay for him to teach the kids lies. And so it's sort of like a common core system that he talked about. So what happened with Athens? They got so chaotic because of what I mentioned that when Philip of Macedon begins conquering some of the Greek city-states, Philip of Macedon paid citizens in Athens money under the table, and so when they met in the marketplace to talk politics, these people would get up and lie, and people would say, well, we got to get our defense against Philip of Macedon. And they would say, wait, just hold on a second. I heard that this Philip's not such a bad guy. I heard he's not conquering these cities. He's liberating them, and they love him. And then these paid propagandists would gather around themselves what Lenin later called useful idiots, people that believed the lies. They would march with their signs, so to speak. And so this so confused Athens that when Philip of Macedon marches up to the walls, they're in confusion. They just throw the gates open. He marches in. He takes over. And from that point on, the people of Athens never made their own decisions. After Philip came his son Alexander the Great. And after him came some, you know, Roman emperors, and then the Byzantine emperors, and then the Muslim sultans, and then they finally got their freedom in Greece in the 1800s, but they lost it a few times with the Ottomans in World War I. They got it again. They lost it World War II. They got it again, but then they joined the EU, and now they're in debt. Now the people of Athens don't make their own decisions again. And so a people ruling themselves is a very rare occurrence in world history. It's like a parking lot with a dandelion sprouting through the cracks. I mean, that's how rare it is in this pavement of totalitarian dictators and kings for a people to rule themselves. So we looked at Israel under the judges, that first period. We looked at Athens. And if you want, I can give you a little bit on the Roman Empire.
Absolutely. Sure, painting quite a picture here that we as Americans need to take note of so that we can learn from our history.